Ladies and gentlemen, if I could call the meeting to start. I'm sorry we're a few minutes late. On behalf of the staff of the Theatre Museum, I'd like to welcome you all here today, and it's fantastic to see so many of you here. This is the 10th STR Book Award, so it's a celebration, I think, just in itself, that it's hit its first decade, which I think shows a lot about its importance and the growing importance of promoting the performing arts in the publishing arena. I don't want to hijack this meeting, but a lot of people already this morning have asked me about what's exactly happening about the Theatre Museum. So I was just going to deflect the meeting for about 1 minute just to say what is actually happening, to save me having to repeat it endlessly and to sort of get it all out in one go. Because there's so much sort of bits of odd information have floated around. The Victoria and Albert Museum has now decided that there will be permanent performing arts galleries at South Kensington. For any of you that know the building, it's what's known as Galleries 103 to 106, which probably doesn't mean anything to anybody, but it's on the first floor, and it's currently they're currently furniture galleries. And that will be turned in, over to the performing arts and will provide about 600 square metres, which is obviously less space than here, but at least is something given... what's happened. The permanent galleries probably won't be in place 2009-2010, but on the 21st of November we'll be opening the first exhibition there, which is in fact the Society of British Theatre Designers exhibition, the quadrennial exhibition Collaborators, which is the exhibition that they take to Prague to show contemporary theatre design on the international arena. And what we'll be doing is showing the theatre designs which are going to Prague in June, and the addition of some of the other designers who were shown at the Nottingham exhibition, the open exhibition, which we jointly feel of interest. The opening of that is on the evening of the 20th of November, which is a Tuesday, and you'll all be very welcome to come. We'll try and invite as many of you as here as possible, but if you don't get an invite and you want to come, you'd be very welcome on that occasion. And then just two other final things to say. One is that the education programme of the museum is continuing in this building, certainly till August. So if you know of schools and all the rest of them, do make it clear that it's still available, although numbers are keeping up reasonably well. And the other thing is, although the building is closed to the public in terms of just walking through the front door, there are tours of the building, short tours at 12 and 3 o'clock every day. So if you've got friends or people coming into London over the next few months who want to come and look around what's here, please do direct them here. And finally, although it's probably not quite what I'd have expected to do as the first performance exhibition at South Kensington, it is rather gratifying that Kylie Minogue, I don't know how many of you have been to see the exhibition, has proved to be the second most popular exhibition ever at the V&A. It's currently attracting over 2,500 visitors a day, which shows at least there's a public hunger for at least one area of the performing arts. On which point, I'd like to hand over to Howard, who is the master behind all this, who puts an enormous amount of effort into making it all happen. And so, particularly as it's the 10th, I'd like to give you all to give him a big round of applause for getting this far.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Now, I'd like to welcome on behalf of the Society for Theatre Research. It's good to see you all back here again, even if it probably is for the last time. There'll be a little bit more about the museum later, but books first, that's what we're here for. First, thanks to the authors, the editors, the publishers who brought them out and entered them for the prize. If you are an author yourself and your book hasn't been entered and was eligible, and it should be on display over there. If it isn't, then talk to your publisher and ask them to make sure they enter things next year. We've had an enormous range of books. They've ranged from gossipy autobiography to very heavy academic books that the judges have had some effort reading, and they've been kept pretty busy. While that's been largely pleasurable, we've noticed quite a few cases of literals and sloppy editing. I used to be an editor. One book even has its title misspelt on the cover. But don't blame the editors. I know the commercial pressures they often work under these days. Accountants and sales directors may not care about such things, but they do matter to the reader. I am delighted to be able to praise the readability of so many of the academic books submitted. One entry wasn't quite so happy. They were so busy trying to be with it and give it a design approach that it had the opposite effect and people found it rather impenetrable. I'm not going to try and give a rundown of the overall entry we had this year. In a moment, the judges will be talking about the shortlisted titles and some of the others that they particularly liked, even if they didn't quite make it. But I'd also like to put in an oar for a couple. Digitalisation and computers have helped to lower the cost of illustrated books, even if reproduction rights have got more expensive. We are seeing more picture books which deal with the theatre. My thanks, therefore, to Oberon and John Nelson for his visual history of The Ring as it's been produced at Covent Garden. Not quite so strong on pictures, Barbara Revelhoffer's book on the early Stuart masque from Oxford University Press is also most welcome as an attempt to rediscover performance. And from the same house, David Worrell's Theatric Revolution gives a fascinating overview of the place of theatre in late Georgian culture and comes closest to my mind to an explanation of the royal patent system that I've ever found. Another very readable academic book comes from Ashgate. The Cult of Keen by Geoffrey Cahan gives us much more than its blurb suggests. It's not just about others' views on Keane and later fictionalisation of him, but it gives real insight into this fascinating actor. There's no time to mention any more, even though they may be worthy of your attention. Take a look at them later if you haven't already. All the entries are out there on display. But I do want to take a moment to draw attention to the contribution of the smaller publishers. Nick Charlesworth's Badger Press, for instance, with its histories of regional theatres. These books are often a labour of love by the writer, and they may not have the skill and experience of their competitors, but even if they don't win the prizes, they do make a valuable record for British theatre. Then there are the theatre specialists, such as Nick Hearn and Oberon. This year, surprisingly, neither on the shortlist. What would we do without them? Play scripts are outside the remit for this prize, but how often do you see the big imprints publishing new plays these days the way they used to, publishing unknown writers as Tom Masher did at Cape, Story, Wesker, they were unknown when he first published them, or Giles Gordon at Penguin with collections of new plays from the 60s. Thank you, James and Nick, and sometimes Favour and Methrin Drama too, for these instant and inexpensive scripts we often buy instead of programmes. That's enough from me. Let's move on to the actual shortlist. Richard Mangan, former performer, stage manager, director, and for nearly 20 years, administrator of the Mandarin Richardson Theatre Collection, is going to start us off. Richard.
Thank you. Before I start, I just want to draw your attention. There is a book, which I'm not going to speak about, but it is about the Cottesloe Theatre. And today we have in our midst the director of that theatre at that time, Bill Bryden, and it happens to be Bill's birthday. So, happy birthday, Bill. I want, first of all, to say thank you very much to Howard for inviting me to be one of the judges for this year's Society for Theatre Research Book Prize and thereby augmenting the Mander and Mitchinson Library, and also to have the pleasure of meeting my fellow judges, Heather Neal and John Woodvine, over the two, only two, enjoyable lunches which were our reward. I'd like to say that I read all the books on that table from cover to cover. I'd like to say that, but it wouldn't be true. mainly because I simply wasn't clever enough to understand some of them. I took some of them away with me on a short break with some friends in January, and one evening after dinner I embarked on one of these books. The company we were with, all friends, but they included two Oxbridge graduates, two from Durham University, one from Manchester University, and two fairly experienced theatre practitioners. I read them a sentence which was 14 lines long and contained two words which nobody there had ever heard. I persevered for a time, but a sense of my own inadequacy eventually made me desist from the effort. I remember one of Peter Cook's lines in one of his wonderful sketches was, I wanted to be a judge, but I didn't have the Latin. Well, I wanted to be a judge, but I didn't have the English. So apologies in that respect for my own imperfections. However, I would like to mention briefly some of the books which gave me particular pleasure, though they're in no particular order. Robert Leach's Theatre Workshop, Joan Littlewood, and the Making of Modern British Theatre, published by the University of Exeter Press, is an admirable and thoroughly researched account of the most influential of companies. Mr. Leach gives a comprehensive view of the political, social, and theatrical background which caused Joan Littlewood, Ewan Hooper, and a number of other very deeply committed practitioners to establish a company which has had a huge influence over the last 50 years. I was lucky enough, as I think many people here would have been, to have had some contact in my own career with some of those practitioners, such as John Berry and Gene Newlove and Maxwell Shaw. And much of that work is still evident in the training of many students in our theatre schools today and in the work of our major companies. The book is written with students in mind and is to be commended for its great clarity and its lack of jargon. With this book, although it didn't make the shortlist, I want to couple Murray Melvin's book, The Art of Theatre Workshop, from Oberon Books. Murray, of course, is one of the leading lights of Theatre Workshop and is now the honorary archivist of the company. And he therefore brings to the book many personal memories and much first-hand knowledge, as did Howard Gourney, who earlier book, The Theatre Workshop Story, both of these books refer to. Murray's history of the company is concise and it's valuable, but its main attraction and its value is the collection of photographs which he's unearthed, largely from the archive of John Spinner, who photographed much of the company's early work at Stratford East. It's largely thanks to Murray that this wonderful collection now has a permanent home in the archive. And they are an admirable record of that work, and these two books together will, I think, give future generations a true and an indelible impression of that seminal time and activity. Professor Elizabeth Schaefer's book, Lillian Bayliss, a biography, published by the University of Hertfordshire Press and the Society for Theatre Research, looks afresh at that remarkable woman, without whose pioneering work it is unlikely that our National Theatre, our Royal Ballet, or our English National Opera would exist. Professor Schaefer has done much original research and has returned to sources which were perhaps unknown to, or occasionally ignored by, earlier writers. That long-lasting image of the funny little woman at the Old Vic with her odd accent, her podgy features, her banjo playing and her sausage frying may never entirely disappear, but I felt strongly that Liz Schaefer had restored Lillian Bayliss to her rightful place in the history of 20th century theatre and demonstrated the measure of her remarkable achievement in exemplarily lucid and readable prose. Also, in addition to that shortlist, I would like to commend Adrian Woodhouse's biography, Angus McBain, Facemaker, published by Alma Books. This admirably researched book gave me not only a comprehensive history of that master photographer, but also some fascinating glimpses on and off stage for almost half a century. Like John Spinner at Stratford, Angus McBain captured the world of pre- and post-war West End theatre with the eye and the technique of a great artist, and one understands why and how he was able to make those who sat for his camera portraits so grateful for his art. Adrian Woodhouse also has a telling section on the long and arcane tale of Harvard University's purchase of the McBain archive and the subsequent developments thereof. Fascinating to those of us who are in the business. It was also fascinating to let one of our leading producers, our leading impresarios, Duncan Weldon, spent part of his early career as Angus's assistant and was delighted to ask him to take photographs of the production photographs for his first show. Finally, before I hand over to my co-judge, critic and journalist, and Heather Neal, a word of praise for John Fisher's book, Tommy Cooper, Always Leaving Laughing, published by HarperCollins Entertainment. John Fisher is a devotee of many of our great comedians, but I sense that at heart he is, as many of us are, Cooper was the man. This is the work of a fan, a true fan. It's by no means a hagiography, for Tommy was no saint, and John Fisher will be the first to acknowledge that. However, much can be forgiven a man who made so many laugh for so long. Occasionally, some of the contractual details seemed inordinately long, but for the true obsessive, no detail is too much. I am happy to say I read it just like that. Heaven knew.
Thank you, Richard. Well, when I told colleagues that I was to be a judge of this prestigious prize, the reaction was usually along the lines of, you poor thing, that's an awful lot of work, and sometimes, oh dear, there'll be a lot of dross. Well, it was a lot of work, yes, but on the whole, I'm rather pleased with the expansion of my theatre library, and unlike Richard, I haven't actually got a library to put them in, so I now have books everywhere in the house, on the dining room floor and the stairs and the bathroom and everywhere. But anyway, I know I'll refer to many of these again with pleasure. They'll be very useful to have. And as for the rest that are not such a pleasure, well, they'll make some unusual gifts, won't they? But publishers, please, and this is really on behalf of next year's lucky panel, please don't regard the closing date as the one to aim for. I think we received 3 books in the first 6 weeks after the 2006 prize was announced, and then 40-odd in the last 3. It does make a difference, you know. You begin by ripping open the packages and saying, oh, good, another book, what's this about? But then when they come in 20s, you think, oh, I'll look at that later. And so get them in early. In fact, there were couriers who came to my house so often towards the end of December, I considered inviting them to Christmas dinner. They were becoming friends of the family. Anyway, you've heard something of the scope of the task, but I'm going to mention a few titles, some on the shortlist and some not. I like all these, of course, but there were others. I mean, I'm not saying that these are the only ones I enjoyed of all the ones we read. First of all, Staging New Britain, edited by Geoffrey V. Davis and Anne Fuchs, published by Peter Lang. It has a slightly off-putting cover. I must admit I picked this up and put it down a number of times before I really opened it properly to read. Some books might as well scream at you, don't open me, I'm too boring to look at, and it's such a shame because sometimes that isn't the case. This book, actually, it's very well written, it's very interesting. It's about the history and impact of Black and Asian theatre in Britain, and it's told in a lively manner with features many of the best-known names, people you obviously think of, like Yvonne Brewster, Roy Williams, Jacinda Velma, Kwame Kwe-Ama, and many others, as writers and interviewees. So there are many different voices, and they're not all in agreement. It's rather good to have a sort of spread of opinion. And there are 2 useful appendixes, one which summarises the 2001 Eclipse report designed to combat racism in the theatre, and the other the newspaper coverage of the Bechtley affair in Birmingham in 2004. So don't be put off by the rather seriously brown cover. Dominic Drumgoole's very personal Will and Me, How Shakespeare Took Over My Life, is published by Penguin. This is passionate, funny, iconoclastic, a rollicking good read, obviously written at breakneck speed, and admittedly sometimes with more attention to the fun of the subject than proofreading concerns. However, the image of the young Drumgoole declaiming friends, Romans, countrymen, to a herd of cattle for lack of another audience is one to cherish. So I recommend that for teenagers, especially those who think that Shakespeare is for old, boring oldies who wear funny clothes, which would be a shame. The Alchemist Exposed by Robert Butler is published by Oberon Books. This is a particularly good example of that genre of rehearsal process books, you know, where you follow day by day what happens in the lead up to a production. In this case, it was the recent National Theatre production of The Alchemist, directed by Nicholas Heitner. This is written partly with students in mind, though not exclusively, so it'll continue to be useful whether people have seen the production or not, if they're studying the text or indeed theatre practice, or possibly anyone wishing to avoid being taken in by a con man. Or maybe getting some ideas, because there are actually some very good examples of actors who fell for things which came out during rehearsal. Reminiscence Theatre, Making Theatre from Memories by Pam Schweitzer, published by Jessica Kingsley, is a welcome record of an important movement in community theatre since the 1980s. It describes with lots of examples how drama can be a means of sharing between generations and of celebrating personal and local history. And given the plentiful examples, I think this is something of a how-to book as well. I can imagine other people taking it up and trying things out in their own community. And finally, one of my favourite books of the year, which is on the shortlist, Alex Sears' The Theatre of Martin Crimp, published by Methuen. This is an admirably clear assessment of one of our most elusive playwrights, comprehensive, beautifully structured, and providing both the political context in which the individual plays were written and different perspectives from reviewers, not always complimentary, and interviewees, which amongst whom you will find Anthony Clarke, Katie Mitchell, Joe Penhall, Lindsay Posner, Edward Kemp, and lots of others, including, of course, the man himself. There's also an appendix, suitably and rather wittily entitled Attempts on His Life, about Sears the critic's attempts to pin down Crimp the writer. No doubt Crimp the satirist will appreciate that joke. So, there's plenty to celebrate, and I've learned some amazing things during this year, most startlingly perhaps from one of the books that Howard mentioned earlier, The Early Stuart Mask, Barbara Raffelhofer's admirably detailed account from Oxford, which has a lot of fascinating statistics in it, one of which is that a particular costume worn by King Charles I in 1634 was worth the equivalent of 1,166 turkeys. So, well, I'm not going to mention any turkeys at all today, and I'm very pleased to hand over to the other judge, well-known actor John Woodvine.
Now, Richard's already mentioned that two books about Theatre Workshop, and I'd like to mention one by another workshop alumni. Victor Spinetti, Up Front, from Robson Books. He describes Joan Littlewood as my university and gives his picture of Stratford East. Now, I picked this book up a little reluctantly, thinking, oh, here we go, another celebrity autobiography. But it's a little bit more than that. It made me laugh out loud and a lot, and that takes a bit of beating. And on a personal note, I had the pleasure of working with Victor once in television, and, going back, he remembers going to a spiritualist meeting in Wales and being told that he had the gift of healing. Well, when I worked with him, I had a wart on my thumb, and I suppose I was sort of picking at it, and Victor said, wait. And he took hold of it and held it for a moment and said, there, that'll go away, and go away now. And within two or three days, it had gone away. Well, I mean, not a great healer, maybe, but what a charmer. Well, it didn't make the short list, but I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Now, another that didn't quite make it was Jack Shepherd, a book by Jack Shepherd and Keith Dewhurst, Impossible Plays from Methuen Drama, now part of the Bloomsbury Stable with A and C Black. This is the story of the Bill Bryden Company, which occupied the Cottesloe Theatre from 1970 to 1986. Keith and Jack, like many other members of the company, had worked with Bill Bryden either at the Royal Court or at the Lyceum in Edinburgh, and were closely involved in the remarkable achievements of this long-lasting ensemble, the longest-lasting, in fact, ever to have worked within the National Theatre. It's a very warm book. And even at its most serious, it's never far away from some sort of sharp insight or juicy anecdote, and often scurrilous, but always entertaining. It's like sitting in on the best sort of green room or dressing room conversation. I think it's a terrific read. John Osborne, A Patriot for Us, by John Heilpen, from Chatto and Windus, is the first of the short list titles on my list. This biography of the playwright and actor, John Osborne, is a terrific book. It's beautifully written. Heilpern very cleverly draws us into the narrative by starting in the present, with a visit to Osborne's last home, to Helen, his surviving wife, and to his grave. But within a couple of very short chapters, he's got you gripped. And it's then, only then, that he goes back to the beginning with Osborne's difficult childhood and the life of a complex, tortured man whose hand never seemed to be very far from a self-destruct button. Biography at its best. And my last book is The Victorian Clown by Jackie Bratton and Anne Featherston from Cambridge University Press. This book's drawn from two sources, neither of which was intended for publication, and they're both significant discoveries. Both throw new light onto the world of circus in the 19th century and its links with popular theatre. The first part of the book gives an overview of Victorian circus and the background to the two clowns whose manuscripts follow. First come the memoirs of James Froude. He was a clown working in the 1840s and 50s. They were written in old age for his children and present a vivid account of his excitements and hardships of life on the road with a travelling circus. And the last part of the book reveals, I think, a terrific discovery. It can only be described as the gag book of another clown, Thomas Lawrence, who worked a little later in the 19th century. Now, the Victorian clown had a much more important function than those of today. He was there to link all the acts together, not just with physical skills, but also verbally. If things went wrong, he had to cover it up. He combined with the ringmaster to keep the whole show moving smoothly. And if a drama was presented, and it often was in circus in those days, he had to take his part. Now, the gag book's full of old jokes, punning, sketches, topical references, songs, monologues, and demonstrates a clear link to the newly popular music hall, and through that, to variety in the 20th century, and even to some of today's stand-ups. Now, I can't vouch for how this material is going to work, but I'll give you a few little excerpts from the gag book. I shall never forget one evening, me and my sweetheart was taking a walk. She squeezed my arm, I squeezed her hand, and she looked up in my face and said, "Do you love me?" And I said, "Yes." Yeah, well, it was. I say, bless those wives that fill our lives with little bees and honey. They ease life's shocks, they mend our socks, but can't they spend the money? Bad husbands are like bad coals. They smoke too much and they keep going out. Like the bad coals, they're rather a slow burning. What are a lovely woman's sparkling eyes compared with Bagot's mutton pies? A topical reference from a railway alphabet. A stands for accidents frequent, alas. B for the bunglers that bring them to pass. C, the confusion that leads to the same. D, the directors who are never to blame. S for the signals some drivers don't mind. T is a train just 2 hours behind. Well, not a lot has changed in 140 years. Yes. And I'll just end with, it's the last bit of a very long monologue about watches. When we get old, like watches, we find it difficult to go. Our works get out of order, and we're often found too slow. Our days are numbered, like the watch. It's true, as I'm a clown. And like the watch, I now must stop for my mainspring has run down. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. And thanks to all the judges for their diligence in reading the books and their engaging remarks today. Now, regulars will know this is the point at which I usually ask our president, Timothy West, to announce the winner. Well, Tim can't be here. He's appearing with the RSC in Washington, D.C. at the moment. And we don't have an understudy. So what was I going to do? I thought, well, we have to have a guest. And just as a reminder that STR is not all about very heavy elderly academics and very elderly theatre nights, I thought it was time we reminded people that it was also about anybody, young or old, with a serious interest in theatre, theatre history and theatre present. And so I thought, why not ask someone who made his name as a child actor in the movies and has now made a dazzling debut on the West End stage. So if the magic works, please welcome Daniel Radcliffe.
Thank you very much. I am delighted to announce that the winner of the Theatre Book Prize is John Osborne, A Patriot for Us by John Halpern.
The author can't be here, but will the birthday boy come and accept the prize on his behalf, please, as a friend?
It's a very good book, and so is the Theatre Workshop book, which I enjoyed enormously. The influence of Joan Littlewood and her company was tremendously deep in me, as was my friendship and partnership with John Osborne. The good news about this book is that Helen Osborne, the late Helen Osborne, was made very, very sure that she got the right man to write this book. John Halpern from Vanity Fair and from other books was spent a whole year or a year and a half interviewing anybody who was alive who knew John. In a funny sort of way, it was probably just as well that John had passed on before he started, because I think John would probably have hated it. And the only thing I can say about this book is that when the National Theatre opened and Kenneth Tynan came up to John and said to John, "You must write a play for the National Theatre. Come with us and make history." And John, quick as a flash, said, "Ken, I've made history." And he certainly did, and this book is an honour of it. I mean, I think that he was a very controversial, carnaptious, deeply gifted man who opened the door to the theatre of my generation. The first night of Look Back in Anger, just before my time, although it's my birthday, did open the door to a whole lot of writers, actors, directors. The whole theatre as we know it, I think, began on that night, and this is a great tribute to it. And John, I'm sorry John's not here. He deserves all the applause that we can give him. Thank you very much.
Before you all disappear, let's have another drink and cheer the winner. Can I ask you to stay just a moment longer? You obviously have just heard the latest news from Jeff on the situation with the Theatre Museum. The Society for Theatre Research was one of those bodies that helped to set up this museum. There used to be a board at the back with the original founders. on it. That has disappeared. I'm told it's now in a back corridor somewhere. Of the people on that board, the V&A and the Society of Theatre Research, I think, are the only surviving bodies. But there are individuals who still survive, very much so. And one of them is Sir Donald Sinden, who is here today. Sir Donald, will you come and talk about the present situation of the Theatre Museum?
Hello. Now, good morning. Good morning. I'm sure that when I was asked to come along this morning, it was to lighten the proceedings slightly with a few odd quips. But I'm afraid that I'm spitting mad about the Theatre Museum, the demise of. It is disgraceful. And we had the talk at the beginning from Mr. Marsh that the about the exhibition of Kylie Minogue. Why is that not here? This is where that exhibition should have taken place. And the designers' exhibition is going on there. That should have been here. In the next year or so, they're going to have an exhibition on Diaghilev and the Russian Ballet. Why is that not taking place in the Theatre Museum? All of these things could have been here and improved the take at the front door immeasurably. But we're in this dire situation now. But the guardians of the Theatre Museum, we formed ourselves into a group in the fond hope of saving the museum, and they've offered to find the relatively small sum to turn this building into a theatrical landmark that it ought to be. Here we are moving towards our target, and we now need promises of less than £500,000. Now, that sounds quite a lot of money, but compared with a lot of other things, it is a rubbish, small, yes. And you can help by filling in one of the pledge forms that have been distributed today, or by visiting the Guardian's website, to make your pledge, large or small, but preferably large. We have very little time to fulfill our promise, to redeem the V&A's broken promise. The V&A, what makes me spitting mad. However, when you think that how we sweated away 50 years ago to get this place off the ground, and then they can close it just like that. Terrifying. Anyway, that's the case as it is today. We need money at the moment to show willing. So please make a pledge before you leave. I'll round it off by saying, when you want a little joke, not a joke, my brother told me this. And I thought I knew all the family stories, but he told me this one. Now, you need to know that he and I had two aunts, Aunt Florence and Aunt Winifred. And apparently 40 years ago, my brother was staying with Aunt Florence in Worthing. And while he was there, I happened to be interviewed on the radio. So dutifully, Auntie and brother listened to the broadcast. And apparently, in the course of this, I can't remember a thing about it, but apparently, in the course of this interview, I happened to say that I considered that John Gielgud was the greatest actor of the 20th century. Arguable, but I said it. Whereupon Aunt Florence struck the table. She said, "I do wish he wouldn't make pronouncements like that. Your Aunt Winifred and I are great admirers of Wilfred Pickles." Which is rather nice, isn't it? So it does sum it up, doesn't it? So, please do what you can to help us save our beloved Theatre Museum. We will do what we can. Thank you very much.